This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Congress is facing another possible government shutdown at the end of this month if leaders can't agree on a short-term spending package. The proposal could include critical new funding to fight the Zika virus and provide additional money for some veterans programs. But a group of House Republicans also want the bill to block funds for several Planned Parenthood clinics in Puerto Rico, an area that is inundated with Zika cases. Will these issues be resolved in the next 2 weeks? And what's the impact if they're not? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on the air.
And it's great to be on the air.
You know, it kind of feels like deja vu all over again, the prospect of another government shutdown over a spending bill. So how serious is this threat? What's the likelihood that some kind of compromise agreement will not be reached?
I think that we'll get there, but what you said in the beginning is right. It's deja vu all over again. And frankly, I think people are rightly appalled at this. We had this prospect over a year ago when a group in the House was going to shut government down unless basically any funding for Planned Parenthood was eliminated. Now, Speaker Boehner defied them, and what he did is essentially what Paul Ryan, I think, is going to have to do. Speaker Boehner came to the Democrats, and we reached an agreement. Boehner stood up to the Freedom Caucus that wanted to eliminate Planned Parenthood, and we passed a spending bill. So the government lights stayed on and the government functions continued. The situation now in many ways is even worse because we've got this crisis of Zika. Ground zero for Zika in the United States is in Puerto Rico. And on the front lines of fighting Zika is Planned Parenthood. That's the organization that provides services to most of the women in Puerto Rico. And you have to have services because, as you know, Zika is mosquito-borne, but it's also sexually transmitted. So the idea that we would eliminate funds for the organization that is providing the most effective combating of Zika obviously is pretty crazy. I can't believe this will happen, but what it's going to require is that Paul Ryan stare down that element of his caucus that is trying to do to him what they did to Speaker Boehner.
Well, it seems like every day we hear more and more stories about how the Zika virus is expanding into new areas in the southern part of this country. And I think the Obama administration right now is transferring money from other programs to fund their Zika prevention efforts. So if that's the case, why does Congress need to urgently appropriate more money at this time?
Well, we heard from Mr. Fauci or Dr. Fauci. Basically, those administrative gymnastics that the administration is going through to try to get money into the Zika effort, they've run out of options. And you can't keep taking money from one account and putting it into another. There's a little bit of flexibility, and that flexibility has been exhausted. And the real issue here is that when you have a disease like Zika, you've got to get to work and pronto on a vaccine. And to have a vaccine, you have to have phase one trials and then phase two, and they take some time so that you can validate that the vaccine is working and doesn't have adverse health consequences. And our delay on providing security means that you really can't start phase two trials because ethically you can't get people to participate in these trials if you don't have the guarantee that you're going to be able to complete it. So it's a very, very reckless issue where obviously all Republicans and all Democrats don't want Zika to become a big threat in our country. But on the other hand, the ideology that some members have and put above public health and take it out on an attack on Planned Parenthood is really detrimental. And, you know, when I talk to everyday Vermonters, they ask me the question, Peter, look, everybody's against Zika, so why don't you do something on it? And if the folks who don't like Planned Parenthood want to have a vote on that, make that separate. Don't use Zika as a way to take out your point of view on a very good organization.
So it sounds like you feel in the end that Speaker Ryan will agree to a compromise that includes funding for the Planned Parenthood clinics in Puerto Rico?
I do, because it's the only rational thing to do. You know, there's a lot of issues that a lot of us disagree on. But you have to have separate debates and not load up an issue as essential as keeping the lights on in government and use that as the opportunity to try to leverage your will to essentially defeat the majority point of view. But that's especially the case here where in Puerto Rico, the threat of Zika, it's not a threat, it's a real problem. And the consequences of Zika, as we all know, are absolutely devastating, not to mention incredibly expensive. And the notion that you would deny funding to organizations that are now on the front line, providing services to women and families, when the goal is to stop Zika, you would stop the people fighting Zika, that obviously makes no sense.
Today in the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch, and you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Perhaps you have some thoughts about this possible government shutdown. Would it affect you? These are tough times for many dairy farmers. Milk prices are really low, and a new government insurance program that was supposed to help them isn't working the way that many people thought it would. Is it time for a totally new approach? Do you think Congress should pass some gun control legislation in the coming months? Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Congressman, let's look at the presidential race. You were an enthusiastic supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary contest. Now Sanders is campaigning for Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton, and some Sanders supporters are really upset about this situation. They think Senator Sanders is sold out by backing Clinton, that he's betrayed the principles of his political revolution, and they say they're simply not going to vote for her. What do you say to these folks?
Well, first of all, I applaud Bernie. I mean, he showed that he was not only a revolutionary, but he became a statesman. There's a lot of heartache in politics, and nobody worked harder to win that nomination than Bernie Sanders, and probably nobody among his supporters was more disappointed that he came up just a bit short than he was. Yet he knows that if we're going to make this country better, he has got to do everything he can to get Hillary elected and defeat Donald Trump. And he's acting on that. And I think the message to the supporters of Bernie is, you know what, we really do have to make a choice. As much as you may be disappointed, we may be, that the person you wanted didn't make it, there's now a situation where we've got to choose between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And the differences between them are real. You can't just wave them away. So the polling is showing that most of Bernie's supporters are supporting Hillary. I think the question is whether some folks just won't vote or they may vote for a third party. And any of us who were around in 2000, when Ralph Nader got 90,000 votes in Florida, and that tilted the election to George Bush, and then the Iraq War, and then the economic meltdown, know that the consequences of an election can be enormous.
Do you understand, though, why some of Sanders' former supporters are so upset about the current situation? I mean, Bernie Sanders was pretty critical of Hillary Clinton during the primary election.
I do understand it. You know, when you had Bernie doing what I think was an electrifying campaign where nobody thought he had a chance, and he defied a lot of the conventional wisdom. He just got out there and told it like it was. He challenged the kind of economic models that have been in place. He challenged the trade agreements. He really talked about income inequality. And he inspired people who gave their heart and soul to that effort, and they really believe in it. And this is my own experience in politics. There's a lot of heartbreak in politics because it appeals to the best of you to aspire to have the best policies and the best country you can possibly have. And you don't always win. And in fact, you lose more than you win oftentimes in politics as you do in life. And the challenge for each of us is to carry on and to do the best we can to fight another day. But that's a hard lesson to learn, and it's going to be a decision that each person has to make individually as to how they use their energies. So I hope folks get there, but I can certainly understand how disappointing it is that the person that they really, really admire, really got their hearts into, didn't quite make it.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Gerald, who is calling from Pittsford. Hey, Gerald, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask the congressman how much Mexico is paying to fight Zika. Why don't we just double what they're paying?
Well, I take it as a kind of rhetorical question. I don't know what Mexico is paying, if anything. But what I know is that Zika is in the United States. It's in Florida and I think some other southern states, and it's in Puerto Rico. So for our own benefit, we want to protect our own people and do everything we can to eradicate Zika.
Congressman, let's stay with the presidential race for a moment. Late last week, Hillary Clinton was diagnosed with a case of pneumonia. There was that stunning video of her being helped to her car by members of the Secret Service. But a later video showed her outside her daughter's apartment, smiling and walking much, much better. The incident has also raised questions about her overall health and how her campaign didn't release information about her pneumonia for at least 2 days after her original diagnosis. Does that lack of transparency feed into the whole narrative that her campaign is not always being forthright with voters?
Well, you know what? It clearly would have been better for the Clinton campaign to say that she had pneumonia. You know, all of us can get, that's not that big a deal. And when you're campaigning and working as hard as a candidate in a presidential campaign is, you're susceptible to the colds, to flu, to fatigue, to pneumonia. So I think in retrospect, it would have been far better to acknowledge that. And then secondly, it probably would have been a very good reason for her not to stand in the broiling sun, a very hot situation with a suit on when she has pneumonia. So retrospect, yes, I think that she would have been much better off disclosing that. And it is a challenge for the Clinton campaign because Trump's put her in this situation where he's raised these questions about her health. He's revealed nothing about his. He goes on TV with Dr. Oz. And there's really been much less of a disclosure of his medical history than of Hillary's. But I think she's, everything that I can see, I think she's fine. She's healthy. She's been working incredibly hard, and you know, she's back on the campaign trail.
Congressman, a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Don Fowler, who served in that post during the presidency of Bill Clinton, this week called on the Democratic Party to develop a contingency plan in the event that Hillary Clinton has to drop out of the race because of her health. Now, the DNC did use this process back in 1972 when George McGovern's original vice presidential candidate, Thomas Eagleton, dropped out just days following the convention, and Sergeant Shriver was selected by the DNC to replace Eagleton. Do you think the DNC should follow Mr. Fowler's advice and set up a contingency plan? And we also got an email wondering, would you support a draft Bernie movement if this happens?
I don't think we need to set up a contingency plan. I mean, I don't know where Mr. Fowler got that. That happened, as you mentioned, with Mr. Eagleton when it was clear that he was no longer going to be in the race. And we've got a candidate. She went through the whole primary process. Bernie is supporting her, and I think these that speculation by Mr. Fowler, I think, was really over the top. You know, we've got, 53 days to the election, and I would like us to start focusing on what the issues are that this country faces, including the ones that Bernie talked so much about, income inequality. I mean, what we have is a campaign that none of us have ever experienced before, where it's more like a reality show. I mean, the Trump campaign hasn't really put out any positions on issues other than to say they want to build a wall and that he's doing great and he's the greatest. But specific policy positions, he's not offering much to the American people.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Alan in Woodstock.
Yeah. I have a question for Peter here. Does he know anything about a bill in both the House and Senate that will restore the Postal Service delivery practices in Vermont to what they used to be? My church in Rutland is sending out checks to vendors, and as much as 2 weeks go by before they get mail, and they get dunning letters from companies for not paying the bill.
I do know something about this issue. I don't know what specific bill you're talking about, but there's a lot of pressure on the post office, and it's become a contentious, largely partisan issue about what to do. I favor six-day delivery. I want to give the Postal Service some relief from really a requirement that no other governmental agency has. They have to pre-fund their retirement and their health care. Medicare obligations at a rate far in excess of what the actuaries say is required for economic stability and guarantee that those benefits will be provided. So it's like $5 billion a year. And if you put that if you made that the number that it should be, the postal the post office would be doing a lot better. There's been some progress in the Oversight Committee. Jason Chaffetz, the Republican chairman, actually is trying to work with Democrats to get a reform bill that would include maintaining a six-day delivery. So I have some optimism on the House side, where we do have some bipartisan cooperation in the Oversight Committee that has jurisdiction on the Postal Service, that we can make things better.
Today in the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to talk about dairy prices. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Congressman Peter Welch, and our phone number here is 1-800-639-2211. Congressman, as you're very well aware, this has been a tough, tough summer for many dairy farmers in the region. Milk prices have plummeted. We did get this email from Jacques up in Franklin County saying last year's farm bill gave farmers an insurance against low milk prices, which didn't work for us. We got absolutely nothing except for other people making money off of farmers again. And then this year, the cheese buyout for the cheesemakers didn't put a penny in the farmer's pocket again. The solution is controlling production, Jacques wrote us. Do you agree or disagree, Congressman Welch, with a system that would pay farmers a cost of production with a reasonable profit?
I do. I do agree with that. I mean, that's the supply management, and I've long supported that. And we actually had a version of that when we had the Dairy Compact that was in place, started in Vermont, and then became part of the Farm Bill about 10 years ago, probably a little bit more. But that worked, and it was a recognition that you've got to try to have farmers keep production at reasonable levels so that you can maintain a reasonable price and they can pay their bills and make a little money and set aside some money for retirement. So I agree with him. And in fact, I've been always pushing for a supply management program as part of the Farm Bill, and I will do that again. We don't have the votes for that. That's been the real challenge. We had the Dairy Compact. It really did work. So we've got evidence that what Mr. Rainville is advocating works, but there's a lot of opposition to it here, but we'll try again. But the situation now for dairy is really, really tough. You know, I was in the state Senate in the 80s in Vermont, actually when we started the Dairy Compact, and have been in politics in and out of in Vermont since then, and the dairy farmers have always faced these wild cyclical changes where the price is way up for a period of time, and then it plunges, where the cost of grain rises wildly, and it really hurts them. And we're in that one of those cycles now where the cost of grain is around $8, and they're getting paid about $16 per hundredweight. The price is coming up a little bit. Let's hope it comes up a lot more. But that is a real challenge.
So what's the short-term solution? Is just a matter of dairy farmers are just going to have to deal with life as it is?
You know, if you're asking, is there something that we can do here in Washington where we can actually pass legislation that would do what Mr. Rainville's talking about, a supply management, we're going to have to wait until the new Farm Bill before we're going to be able to do that. The things in the interim, Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, and I did advocate to the commissioner that to the Secretary of Agriculture that he increase purchases of cheese. That doesn't put money directly in the farmer's pocket, but it helps keep up the price or stabilize the price of milk, the hundredweight price that farmers are getting. The other thing is that it's really important for the whole state to be doing all we can to support agricultural diversification. Dairy is the backbone, but we are keeping our land open with some of the activities of our younger farmers, many of whom are into vegetables, to cheese production, which obviously includes dairy. So we've got to hang in there. But bottom line here, our farmers face really, really tough times. And we, our hearts go out to them, because unless the price of milk goes up, then it's going to be tougher for all of them to hang on. We lose a dairy farm, it's tough to get it back.
Let's talk to Alexandra in Plainfield. Hi, Alexandra. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, Peter. This is Alexandra Thayer. Good to hear you on the radio. I just wanted, I appreciate your concern for the dairy farmers, but I just also wanted to give some thought in terms of how we're going to get the numbers in Congress. And my own observation is, unfortunately, goes back to Hillary as a candidate and the lack of support for her and the decreasing support for her. And I just am feeling that the Democratic Party is not really having its finger on the pulse as far as how to maintain people in Congress, both in the Senate and the House, because they have been wanting to anoint a candidate who, as you mentioned, there's not policy discussion. I predicted this 15 months ago. We're not talking about dairy policy the way we should be. We're not talking about any number of other policies because we're focusing on Hillary's problems. And I'm just very concerned about the down-ballot elections as well as the presidency. And I'm feeling that the Democratic Party just needs to somehow refocus and think, wait a minute, what are we doing? Is this working? Which, from my perspective, it's not.
Well, Alexandra, I want to say two things. Number one, you speak for a lot of people, and I understand that. And I think Bernie's campaign really helped start changing the party. I mean, he, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and many others have been advocating for us to be focusing very hard on income inequality and economic opportunity for younger people who are getting out of college with wicked debt, and for people who really have been left behind in the globalization of the world economy. So that's a process, and Bernie played a major role in accelerating that, along with somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who I quite admire. But the second thing that I think that we have to acknowledge, too, is that President Obama has done a lot. When you consider, you know, I've served in Congress, this is my 10th year, but I've been here all 8 years of President Obama's administration. And when you look back, you can be proud of some of the accomplishments that were made against implacable opposition. You know, we're out of Iraq. I mean, the Mideast continues to be a mess, but he got ground troops largely out of Iraq. We had the economic collapse as a result of the Wall Street shenanigans, and we had unemployment of around 11%, and the financial sector is stabilized. Unemployment's around 4.5%. We had a report yesterday that finally incomes for low-income and middle-income people have jumped, and that they've been stagnant, but they went up about 5%. So, you know, this challenge that we face, and you've described very well, of making our party and our politics, it's not just Democrats, it's all of us who have some responsibility to make our political institutions more responsive to the needs of everyday people, whether it's improving our schools at home, strengthening our banks, creating jobs. All of us have a role in that. And we're in a much better place than we were 8 years ago, even though there's an enormous amount of work to be done.
Congressman, we got this email from Brad, who would like to know, what can be done to return Congress to a five-day work week? I mean, as it stands right now, doesn't the House usually come in on Tuesdays and maybe adjourn late Thursday?
He's right. And we had a five-day work week when the Democrats were in charge. Nancy Pelosi was the speaker, and we were on a very ambitious schedule, and we had a lot of work to do and a lot of things we wanted to get done. And it wasn't shutting down government. It's when we were in the debate about the health care bill. We passed in the House. It didn't quite make it through the Senate, the Waxman-Markey climate change bill that had it been enacted into law would have reduced carbon emissions by 80% by 2050. We passed the Dodd-Frank bill. All of those were extremely difficult, contentious, long, drawn-out battles. And by and large, when we were with an active agenda, we were here 5 days a week. So how many days we're here is a total decision of whoever is in the majority. And but right now, we have had an immense amount of time in Congress spent on trying to repeal the health care bill. I mean, we voted on that like 64 times. Repeal Dodd-Frank. We just voted on a bill to repeal Dodd-Frank. And it's something that's a source of enormous frustration to Vermonters, because when I speak to them, they just can't stand the gridlock. And what I try to do here is what we would do in Vermont. I try to reach out to my Republican colleagues who say disagree with me on the health care bill, and I say, look, we're not going to repeal it, and you don't have anything to replace it with. Why don't we fix it? Let's identify what some of the problems are and make it better. It's something I did when I worked in the state Senate with Governor Douglas. So we should be here more, but that's going to be a decision that Mr. Ryan and the Republican majority make.
Today in the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Todd in Brattleboro. Hey, Todd, welcome to the program.
Congressman, wanted to ask for your commitment on trying to keep us from a lame duck session, asking you to try and get us a bill for spending that gets us through next year. And to just note that I've not talked to one Vermonter who is interested in the TPP, nor in the lame duck, nor in the gridlock, as you speak of. I hope that you might be able to speak for a minute on your position on that.
Okay, Todd, thanks very much for your phone call. And President Obama has said he might bring the Trans-Pacific Partnership up for a vote in the lame duck. Congressman, we also got this email from Irma saying the TPP is likely to come up for a vote in the House. It would give multinational corporations the ability to challenge laws passed in the United States that could negatively impact their expected future profits. We can't risk giving corporations this kind of power. Will Mr. Welch vote against the TPP?
Well, I think that the question here about the TPP and the lame duck session, I think, is a very compelling one. We've got two candidates who are both opposed to the TPP. Hillary Clinton says she's opposed to it. Donald Trump says he's opposed to it. So I find it very, personally, I can't imagine voting for TPP in a lame duck session where the American people have just voted, whether they voted for Mr. Trump or Secretary Clinton, against the TPP. And I think it would be seen by people as a breach of faith and as kind of an end run around the process. So I do not see – I think the president may well bring up TPP. He's been a very straightforward advocate of that, and it's got foreign policy implications is one of the arguments that he makes. But I do not believe that we should be voting on the TPP in the lame duck session.
And what about the merits of that policy anyway, regardless if it's in the lame duck or if it comes up in the first part of the 2017 session? What are your thoughts about the TPP?
Well, my thoughts about any trade agreement are, what are the details of the trade agreement? I mean, the original versions of the TPP had provisions that would have given pharmaceutical companies enormous power, would have diminished our ability to exercise jurisdiction over them, and there were a number of provisions like that and others that I was strongly opposed to. But, you know, we all know that free trade is good if it's fair trade. So trade is an important component of our economy. The difficulty is trade deals where you are designing them in ways that are very good for corporations and profits, but not good for income growth or job creation at home. So it's the design of the trade agreement that's really, really essential. And what the details are of the TPP that have leaked out so far don't look promising.
Am I right that House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell both support the TPP? And when you add that to President Obama, the likelihood of it coming up during a lame duck might be pretty good?
They could, but it's, well, here's what's changed. Donald Trump is against the trade agreement. That's what he's saying in the campaign. And you have many Republicans who I think are in districts where Trump is getting support that would be not willing to vote for the TPP in a lame duck. So you're right, there's powerful people here, the Speaker, the Majority Leader, and the President who favor TPP. But you have a lot of voters and a lot of members who would be very reluctant in a lame duck session after both presidential candidates have taken positions in opposition to defy that.
Let's talk to Stephen, who's calling from Lake George. Hi, Stephen. What's on your mind today?
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. This is directed to Congressman Welch. Congressman Welch, there are certainly instances where our representatives are held legally responsible, some criminally, such as Sheldon Silver in New York. Regarding the obvious public health threat posed by Zika virus, what are the chances of actually holding individuals like Mr. Ryan criminally responsible for the failure to act on this due to partisanship and party politics?
You know, I think there are none. I don't see that as in the realm of what is called what you're calling criminal responsibility. I mean, it's hard to understand sometimes how people disagree with us. If we think that, hey, we've got to get going on Zika, I'm going to vote for funding, and I'm certainly not going to create additional problems in passing the funding by trying to cut off Planned Parenthood. But some people act on ideological grounds. Some people have honest convictions that are just really different than perhaps yours and definitely mine. So I don't see that the criminal option is at all relevant here, even though it's, I think, a life and death situation on trying to get the Zika virus contained.
Today in the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to talk about escalating drug prices. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Congressman Peter Welch. You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Congressman, you're a member of the House Oversight Committee, and this week the chairman of that panel announced that the committee will hold hearings on the skyrocketing cost of some prescription drugs. Now, the drug companies argue that they spend millions and millions of dollars researching new life-saving drugs and that they need to recoup these expenses when they are able to bring a new drug to the marketplace. So if that's the case, what are they doing wrong?
They're doing a lot wrong and taking advantage of a broken market. And that hearing we're going to have is all about the EpiPen price spike. And that hearing is being done as a result of a requested Tammy Baldwin, Congresswoman from Illinois, and I made to Jason Chaffetz. You know, here's the problem with prescription drugs. Our drug companies, including Mylan, you know, that has got a big plant in St. Albans, do things that are very important. Drugs extend life, and they alleviate pain. That's a good thing. But the market is broken, and the prices they're charging are killing us. And that's really the challenge. When you have a company that buys a drug that has been around so long, it isn't even covered by patent protection, and that happened with that guy Martin Shkreli, and it happened with Mylan and EpiPen. They bought a drug that had been on the market, been used for a long time, and they were the only ones now in control of it. There's a broken market where there's no competition, and they can just spike the price and spike the price and spike the price. And people who need that adrenaline shot that comes with EpiPen, they have to have it, whatever the price is. I mean, it's a life and death situation. And I'm finding that more and more of my Republican colleagues who originally were very resistant to my advocacy for prescription drug price negotiation or even any kind of what they regarded as interference in the market, understand that the problem is the market is broken. It's not transparent. The price you pay varies depending on what health plan you're in. You've got these prescription benefit managers. Everybody gets a cut. Drug companies that have a product that whose patent is expiring, then pay a generic company not to compete with them so that they can keep the price really high. And this is really terrible and not sustainable because it's a wicked expense for taxpayers, for consumers, and for a lot of our employers that are doing their best to provide employer-sponsored health care. So we've just got to get some controls on these escalating prices that are just crippling consumers and taxpayers.
But realistically, what can Congress do in the short term?
A lot. This is an area where we really can and must do a lot. Number one, allow Medicare to negotiate bulk price discounts. Medicare is the biggest purchaser of prescription drugs. That's the Medicare Part D program. Under the law that implemented Part D, Congress prohibited Medicare from negotiating bulk price discounts. I mean, that's truly bizarre. It would be like you going into the local pharmacy and deciding you were going to buy 10 aspirin or 100 aspirin, and you look at that per unit cost, and the per unit cost when you're buying 100 is a lot less because you're doing a bulk purchase. Well, the government is on a massive scale higher than that, and it is handcuffed when it comes to price negotiation. So that's an example. Another example is we can pass a law that prohibits companies where they have a drug and the patent is expiring from then paying off a generic to not bring their generic product to the market so that that company that has the patent can enjoy a couple more years of, quote, market exclusivity, which means they can keep raising the price without the fear of any kind of competition. So there are very concrete things that we can do and should do in order to make have a market mechanism apply some discipline to the pricing of prescription drugs.
Let's talk to Clark, who's calling from East Dorset. Hi, Clark. Welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you? What I want to talk about is I understand that Zika is a big concern and seems to have gotten the media spotlight. But the one thing that really concerns me is Lyme disease. The CDC admits there are at least 300,000 new infections a year and admits that there might be 10 times as more. And yet, while we're proposing $750 million for Zika, the National Institute of Health has only advocated $150 million for Lyme disease, which has really incredible long-term life changing implications. Thanks.
Well, you're right about Lyme disease. And Chris Gibson, who is my Republican colleague that represents the district across Lake Champlain, he and I have worked on a Zika bill to try to get more emphasis on studying it and getting a cure for it. But you're exactly right. I mean, you know, if you're affected by Lyme disease, that's the disease that you focus your attention on. And we shouldn't have it be a competition among diseases. The reality is that Lyme disease is very, very harmful and very difficult and can be very, very debilitating for a very long time. So it does deserve, as you say, a focused attention of the NIH. But that certainly shouldn't come at the expense of the incredible plight of folks with Zika.
Congressman, we got this email from Scott in Rutland who wrote us, many people in the city of Rutland, including the Board of Aldermen, have both informally and through the Freedom of Information Act requested information from the State Department regarding Rutland becoming Vermont's next refugee resettlement site. This information is being sought in order to learn how it's being determined that our small city of nearly 17,000 people has the capacity to successfully settle 100 refugees on an annual basis. And Scott wants to know, Congressman, are you willing to contact the State Department and request that their decision to resettle refugees in Rutland be placed on hold until they explain to city officials how our capacity to resettle refugees was determined?
Well, I'm not going to contact them and ask them to put it on hold. I mean, this is a debate that folks in Rutland are having. And I think two things about it. First of all, I think all of us do have some responsibility to try to help do our share for the enormous suffering that's occurring in Syria with those folks who are really living under barrel bombs. Number two, I am aware that the vetting process for any Syrian who's seeking asylum in the United States is extremely extensive, because I can appreciate that folks in Rutland have a concern about security and they have a concern about the economy. But the vetting process that a refugee has to go through literally takes about 2 years. It's long and it's exhaustive. And the predominant number of people who are coming are women and children. So I think that that vetting process is exhaustive. And then third, the economic issues, the State Department can't figure that out so much. That's really, I think, a lot of discussion in Rutland about what we can do and how we can do it. And I'm following a lot of the press on it, and I'm talking to a lot of folks in Rutland, and there's a vigorous debate about that. You know, my Rutland is just a fantastic city that has been benefited by tremendous people who've come to America and built lives, built families, and built an economy. And Rutland's having a vigorous debate about that. And the more information we can get out to people so they can have their questions answered, the better. So I'm hopeful that State Department can answer what questions are there. But I don't think it was an economic analysis that the State Department did. I could be wrong on that, but I don't think that's been the heart of the decision.
Let's look at the larger issue of Syria. There's a partial ceasefire in effect there now. What should U.S. policy be aimed to do?
To bring the violence to a halt. And that's not something we can do on our own. And it's just brutal and heartbreaking. Because what you have in Syria now is violence completely unleashed. And it's ethnic. It's also religious. And the fact of the matter is that in order to bring a ceasefire, as much as we may not like to do it, we have to work with the Russians because they have some leverage with the Assad regime. So, in fact, that Russia and that the United States are actually trying to coordinate an effort for this temporary ceasefire. And then hopefully we'll focus their targeting on ISIS. The ISIS adversary is the most promising thing I've heard in quite a long time in what has just been a devastating and heartbreaking loss of life for millions of innocent people.
Do you think the United States has to consider military action?
It won't work. I really don't. I mean, it's heartbreaking when you see the images of Syrian refugees or that child, that infant who was washed up on the shores of the beach. I mean, you want to go in and do what you can. But the United States, with a military occupation, we've just had the lesson of Iraq. Once we're there, it's not as though people want us there. And then we become the object of all of that hostility. So the question is, what can we do that has a practical prospect of alleviating the suffering? And I don't believe that military force or an occupation army like we had in Iraq would work. I don't think it's wise, but I also don't think it's effective.
So what do you think the outlook in Syria is? Do you have any cause for optimism?
The outlook in Syria has been bad and getting badder. And the first hint of optimism I have is this breakthrough. Let's hope it actually works, that there'll be some cooperation between Russia that has the ear of the Assad regime, which has been a murderous regime, in working with the United States, where they'll focus on ISIS. So will that work? I don't know. I mean, I wish I could say to you, Bob, I'm optimistic, but that is just a cocktail of violence that has a long way to go before it burns itself out.
Congressman, we're almost out of time, less than a minute, but it's certainly a very polarizing election this year. No matter who's elected president, do you think you're looking at another 4 years of gridlock in Washington?
I certainly hope not. Hope springs eternal. I work really hard with Republicans down here on the top line issues where they, on taxing and spending, it's always tough. But below that line, like on prescription drug price negotiation or just on the rural call completion issue that I work with Bob Latta, there's a lot of things we can do. But what I know is that if America is going to be strong, this institution has to work. And it means that as tough as it is, I can't be pessimistic about it. I've just got to show up to work every day and try to find Republicans I can work with find common ground and move ahead. You know, I just got back from a trip which concerned the refugees with the majority leader, Kevin McCarthy. I work with Paul Ryan on cheese issues. So I'm reaching out and doing all I can the way Vermonters do.
All right, Congressman, that's all the time we have for today, but many thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll take a detailed look at a new report from the Public Assets Institute that calls for greater investment in a number of human service and education programs. Liam Connors directed our program today. The executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening.